I had to tell the world the truth because human beings every day, mostly women and children, are not only dying as a result of American bombs dropping on them, but through a mechanism of American paid starvation.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to another episode of Deep Focus. This is an important one to me. You know, the whole world is focused right now on Iran and on the Persian Gulf and on the movement of U.S. Aircraft carrier battle groups to the region. And many of us have had our attention diverted away from Gaza and what's happening in Palestine. Well, things are still very bad in Palestine. And in fact, just over the past couple of days, we've seen daily death tolls of Palestinians ranging from 11 to 60. And now we're starting to see violence in the West Bank. Well, there's been a whistleblower from the United States military by the name of Anthony Aguilar, who went public last year talking about a bunch of different things that he saw. He witnessed contractors, for example, firing automatic weapons into a crowd of civilians. He reported that a young man named Amir was killed by gunfire shortly after collecting aid at one of the distribution centers. And as I've said many times in the past right here on the show, there is a legal definition of whistleblowing. It is bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. Try doing that in a war zone and see what happens to you. Many of you also know that I'm a member of a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. I'm very proud to be a member of that group. It's largely made up of retirees from the CIA, the FBI, NSA, DOD, and other intelligence community entities. Well, every year we give a major award to a whistleblower who has made the biggest contribution to whistleblowing in the national security. We gave our award this year to Anthony Aguilar. Anthony is a retired lieutenant colonel. He graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point before getting a master's degree at the University of Texas. He's also the recipient of the Bronze Star with V for Valor. He didn't get this Bronze Star because he learned how to speak a language and translated for some general. V for Valor. He's a recipient of the Purple Heart. And as I said a moment ago, a recipient of the Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence. And we are very happy and very fortunate to have him with us today. Anthony, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the introduction, and it's an honor. I'm humbled to be here and speak with you today. Thank you.
I'm thrilled. And we were thrilled from the moment that you said yes. There's so much that I want to ask you about. Every once in a while, Anthony, there is a military whistleblower, but usually not one, first of all, as senior as you are, you're a lieutenant or retired lieutenant colonel, or one as well-placed as you were. You didn't blow the whistle on, you know, some kind of, you know, inflated contracts that you found in the contracting office at the Pentagon. You were on the ground during a hot war. And that's after having served in hot wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us about getting to Gaza, what your job was in Gaza, and then how things played out while you were there.
Well, you know, in my final duty position in the United States Army, I was assigned to United States Army Special Operations Command as a senior operations officer. So I retired with quite a bit of experience, having just come out of battalion command. So when I retired, I was not seeking government work. I was not seeking a contract work. I was not seeking any type of work in that field. In fact, I was preparing myself to start school in the fall to go to Duke to law school. I wanted to be a public defender. Oh. So I was getting ready to go to start law school. So I was focused on that. And then May 13th of 2025, I get a phone call from a local North Carolina number, which I typically don't answer numbers that I don't know. But this was local, my area code. So I thought it may have been something, you know, important. So I answered it, and it was from a company called UG Solutions. And I had never heard of UG Solutions, and they explained to me that they were a contracting company that was going to provide security under this new Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was also an organization that I had never heard of. So I asked them, I said, well, that's, you know, why are you reaching out to me? I don't have contracting experience. And they said, well, this is we're embarking on setting up this new aid. It's going to replace the UN mechanism, and we need senior planners and people that have your experience. And I said, well, how long do I have to think about it? And they said, well, we're leaving Thursday. And this was on a Tuesday. And I said, so I guess I don't have much time to think about it. So I sat down and I kind of wrote my facts, like, what does Tony know? And this is what I knew to be true at the time, that Palestinians in Gaza are starving to death. They are starving, in addition to being bombed and in this horrible conflict, and they are starving, and aid has to go in. At the time, aid, fact number two, aid was not going in. The UN had been blocked from going in. The ceasefire in March had collapsed. UNRWA was declared to be Hamas infiltrated, so no aid was going in. And then the third thing I knew to be true is that, well, they're starving people, no aid is going in, and this new mechanism is going to be providing food. So I wanted to help. So I signed up and said yes, because I wanted to be part of the solution to helping starving human beings. So days later, I found myself in Tel Aviv and getting briefed on about our operation, and went into Gaza. And that's how we ended up there, from retired to back on the ground in a war zone in a matter of days.
Days. And then once you got to Gaza, what was daily life like for you, obviously, but also for the average Gazan that you were trying to help? How bad was bad?
So the first time I actually went into Gaza was on the 24th of May. We went in with an escort from the IDF to get eyes on these newly established secure distribution sites that would be the, you know, what that would take over for aid distribution. And what struck me as odd in the first place was that under the UN and UNRWA and various NGOs and UN humanitarian organizations, they were operating 400 distribution sites daily in Gaza, because everything that's needed to sustain life, existence, has to be brought in. And in order to meet that requirement for 400 distribution sites every day, the requirement was 600 trucks of aid into Gaza from various crossing points, primarily from Egypt through Rafah, every day into Gaza. And when I saw that requirement, I thought, like, wow, our work is going to be cut out for us. I mean, 600 trucks a day, 400 sites. I was like, man, we better get to work. So when we first went into Gaza, I expected that we were going to be seeing, you know, a handful of these sites and understanding the operational flow. And we were shown three sites and we were told, that's it. We're only running three sites. And when we saw the truck supply that we had, the number of trucks that GHF purchased under the contract, there were only 12. So we're operating 12 trucks, three sites for the entire population of Gaza. And I asked myself right off the bat, like, how is this even possible? How are we going to sustain the population? And when they took us to these sites, we drove through Rafah, which is in southern Gaza, borders Egypt. Tel al-Sultan is where Rachel Corrie was killed in 2003, this same area. And as we were driving to the first distribution site, we had to go through the ruins of Rafah. And I immediately saw what stood out to me as not only devastation, but a clear departure of Geneva Convention and stepping well into the realm of war crimes. And mind you, my experience, my lens that I saw this through, was not through someone that spent their time in an office or behind a desk. I have had boots on the ground in every war the United States has been involved in since 2000. Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Tajikistan, Yemen, Somalia, Southern Philippines. I've seen destruction at scale, especially in Syria when we were fighting ISIS. So what immediately stood out to me is I saw the ruins of mosque towers and the collapsing and bombardment of hospitals and schools as we're going through Rafah. And as we were driving through, we had stopped at one point because the IDF were bulldozing ahead of us to clear some of the rubble because they were freshly bombing in southern Gaza. And as we stopped, I could hear the cries from the rubble of human beings crying out for help, the people that were buried in the rubble. And the whole idea of, you know, no civilians are being killed or we're only targeting tunnels, that notion immediately was shattered. And I realized that that's not what's going on here. And then the distribution points themselves, I brought this up in the very beginning to the leadership, that the distribution points were purposely built and established in the operational combat area of the Israeli offensive in Gaza, which was called Operation Gideon's Chariots. That was the offensive through southern Gaza that we witnessed throughout the year. And then more recently in August, Operation Gideon's Chariots 2 was the offensive into Gaza City. So we were there right in the middle of this. And I brought it to the attention of the IDF and to the GHF leadership that it is a violation of the Geneva Convention to establish distribution sites that are intended to feed or aid non-combatants and set them up in an active combat zone. Because you're inherently putting the population at known risk. And I was you would have thought that I had grown a second head. They were looking at me like, what are you talking about? That doesn't apply. That doesn't apply here. And I'm like, it absolutely does apply. And Israel is a signatory to the fourth protocol of the Geneva Convention, as well as the United States. We can't do this. And, you know, I really thought it was a problem to fix, that this was poor planning, right, that this was just right ignorance.
Sure, because that's your professional experience.
Yeah. Okay, so this is something to fix. And then once I realized clearly that this was not something to fix, that this was the actual intended plan from the beginning, that the GHF was knowingly involved in the planning prior to us getting to Gaza, and was the plan throughout execution, limiting the food, purposely withholding water. We provided no water during this humanitarian aid operation. Limiting the food to where only, if you were to disperse the amount of food that we brought in over the whole population, it would equate to one meal every third day for the population. So and a meal, by the way, that was not a prepared meal, but was simply dried food, parceled goods, dried rice, flour, dried pasta noodles, dried fava beans.
Not an MRE.
Beans.
Right.
Not a meal that was prepared, not a field ration. No, this was dried food that needs water to be prepared, and we were not providing water. And that was intentional, because when I asked about that, I brought up after about the third day of operating, when I witnessed, when I was present and witnessed our first site being overrun by 34,000 starving people. And on the second day, when I witnessed the IDF shooting into the crowd and killing a young boy. And then on the third day, when I witnessed a UG Solutions contractor shooting into a crowd of unarmed Palestinians and killing a man, I proposed this plan for change, a 15-page document that I wrote. Here's how we change security. Oh, by the way, you should probably provide us training on these weapons that you provided us, on these non-lethal munitions you provided us. No, they provided us no training. They just basically gave us guns and stun grenades and tear gas and riot batons and said, here, go into Gaza, with no training. And so I proposed, you know, training, standard operating procedures, rules of engagement, a plan to expand our distribution times based on the limited resources that we had. And I was flat out rejected, not considered, not, oh, we'll look into it, flat out rejected, saying, no, we are operating by the conditions of our contract. And I was like, well, explain this to me. What do you mean? Why aren't we providing water? Is that a condition of the contract? And they provided me a copy of the contract with between GHF and the Israeli government through COGAT, the Coordinating Office of the Government Activities in the Territories. And it stated very clearly that we would not be providing water, that we would only be providing a set limit of food, that we would operate under the control of the IDF, which sites we distributed from, what times we distributed, if we even distributed at all on any given day. There were days that we just didn't distribute any food at all. And it became very clear to me that, okay, this is not a result of ignorance, poor planning, or ineptitude. This is intentional. This is by design. And that really opened my eyes to what the situation really was, to where it's something that, one, I could not be a part of, and that, two, I had to tell the world the truth, because human beings every day, mostly women and children, are not only dying as a result of American bombs dropping on them, but through a mechanism of American paid starvation.
I have a follow-up question for you in one moment. I hate to even take a break, but we have sponsors that I need to attend to. This week, Donald Trump nominated Kevin Warsh to lead the Federal Reserve. Most people saw the headline and just moved on. But there's something here worth paying attention to. Warsh was openly supported, or has openly supported, developing a U.S. central bank digital currency, a system where your dollars exist as programmable code instead of physical cash. I spent 15 years at the CIA. I know how surveillance infrastructures work. And I know that capabilities built for one purpose rarely stay limited to that one purpose. A digital dollar has the potential to let the government track every transaction you make, freeze your account without a court order, restrict what you can purchase, automatically deduct fines or taxes, even put expiration dates on your own savings. I'm not saying that that's the plan, but I'm saying that that is the capability. And once that infrastructure exists, history shows that it gets used. That's why I've partnered with American Alternative Assets to bring you a free report called The Digital Dollar Trap. It breaks down what's being built, who's behind it, and how physical gold could help protect your savings from a system designed for control. It's easy. Go to johnlovesgold.com to download your free copy, or call 1-888-GOLD-053. That's johnlovesgold.com or 1-888-GOLD-053. Anthony, I've been in something of a similar position to you, but not one where people were literally starving to death around me. This had to be shocking to your sensibilities as a military professional. So you get to see the contract, and then what? Were you the only person in the organization that was saying, wait a minute, this isn't right, we have to do something about this?
I was not the only one. In the very beginning, in fact, the second in command, if you will, the 2IC of the entire contract, after the very first day when we were overwhelmed by 34,000 Palestinians without enough food to feed, and we saw children, you know, when you see a mother dragging a wooden pallet with a rope, and on that pallet are her dead children because they starved to death or they lacked medical treatment, or you see a father who walked 10 kilometers to get to that site simply to find out that there's no food left, and he's carrying his dead child in his arms that starved to death the day before. And when you see that at scale, and you know that it's by design, it really breaks a part of your human spirit that is often, or that is rarely touched. And after that day, quite a few of the contractors, a handful, quit in protest. And shortly thereafter, other contractors worked with me to try to fix this problem, to try to do an asset. Like there were some other contractors that were former Green Berets, and we try to sit down and make a plan to how do we fix this situation. And then once it was realized that the problem's not going to be fixed, more contractors left. And then after I resigned and left, numerous contractors left as well. And what I will say is that what was really indicative to that falling apart of the structure was on the 26th of May, the very first day we kind of cut the ribbon, this great operation's going to unfold. Jake Wood, the director of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, you might remember that name from the days of Blackwater and Triple Canopy in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the same Jake Wood. Now runs an organization. He was running multiple organizations, and he stepped down as the director of the GHF. He said, I cannot be a part of this. It's become clear to me that this will not be done in humanitarian principles, and I can't be a part of it. And that was on the first day of operation. The director of GHF stepped down. And then he was replaced very quickly, almost as if it was planned, with a gentleman named Johnny Moore, who is a self-proclaimed evangelical Christian Zionist, who was on Donald Trump's religious advisory board in his first term, who was, you know, brought back in off the bench, dust off the old cleats, let's bring you back in the field. So he was then made the director of the GHF almost immediately. And that gave me pause to think, because I'm like, why is the person in charge of the GHF not someone that has a deep understanding of humanitarian aid? Who is this guy? And as others started to leave in protest, some of the contractors, before I even resigned, went to the press, but they did it anonymously. And when I resigned, I knew that I had to speak to Congress, and I knew that in speaking to Congress that I could not do it anonymously. And a big support for that was, you know, my family. And my family explained, you know, when I said, I have to tell Congress about this, but I think I'm going to just, you know, ask to be anonymous. And my family said, that's not appropriate, and that's not the person you are. That would be a cowardice move to go tell what's happening and not put yourself, your name behind it. You have to step up and speak about it. So I made that decision to go all in, that I'm going to speak out about it. I'm going to own it, and I'm going to stand behind it.
Well, let me interrupt you on that point. When I decided to go public on the CIA's torture program, it was as though the entire weight of the American government fell on my head. Was that your experience? Did you have people who you liked, trusted, had worked with, take exception with your whistleblowing? What was the fallout like?
Well, you know, from fellow officers and professionals that I served with, there was a lot of support. From individuals that have been influenced and compromised by this this growing class of violent, almost this warmongering class within the military, there was a lot of pushback in terms of the a lot of people came out of the woodwork. Oh, he was horrible in the military, and he never amounted to anything and was kicked out. And
I'm there, like, you okay, go.
Well.
Yep.
I was like, that, well, I served 25 years as a Green Beret. So, you know, if that's not doing well, then, you know, I'd sure like to see what your definition is. So what came first
that's
was
right.
not the attacks on the claims that I made. It was attacks at me directly. And that's when I knew.
Yes.
That's when I knew that what I was speaking was true, and that they were afraid of it,
mm-hmm.
because they couldn't attack
That's
the substance.
That's exactly right.
So they had to attack
That's right.
me. And what they didn't anticipate in attacking me is that when it comes to achievements of the past, or what I did in the military or didn't do in the military, or who I was as an officer or not, what anyone else thinks doesn't matter to me. it doesn't impact me. It doesn't have the effect that they thought that, my former fellow colleagues don't think I'm good anymore, and I should back off. No, it doesn't change the fact that in my military record, I've as you've mentioned, I earned the Bronze Star for Valor for heroism in combat, the Purple Heart. I commanded all the way to the battalion command level, graduated from West Point. I mean, if anybody wants to say that I had a bad military career, then go ahead, because the proof dictates otherwise. So I'm fine with the trash talk, if you will. It's the equivalent of someone, writing something on the bathroom stall of a cheap dive bar, and you read it. And if you take that personally, then you know, you're probably need to examine your own self-esteem. So it didn't bother me. I was like, okay. I mean, I basically said, okay, let's take it for, let's say I was a horrible military officer, and you know, I didn't amount to anything, and I'm just this horrible person. Does it change the fact that you killed unarmed civilians? Because I have that on video. Does it change that? Does it change that fact? No, it doesn't. And then the criticism stopped, because they realized that I wasn't going to stop talking. So they decided, I think at one point they decided, don't say anything, let this die. And here I am, still speaking out, and I will until there's justice.
I'm smiling because, well, not because it's a funny issue. It's not. It's gravely serious. I'm smiling because they did exactly the same thing to me. They did the same thing to Thomas Drake at NSA. They did the same thing to Jeffrey Sterling at CIA and to Daniel Hale at the Department of the Air Force. They attack and attack and attack you personally, not the information that you've brought to light, but you personally. That is always a losing strategy, because it proves your point. They can't attack the information because the information is true. You know, I remember a former boss of mine who was an associate deputy director of the CIA testified against me in the grand jury. And we got a copy of his testimony, and he said that I was never much of an officer to begin with. Well, that's funny, because he gave me 10 exceptional performance awards. He gave me the Counterterrorism Service Medal for the capture of Abu Zubaydah in Pakistan. He presided over the Deputy Secretary of State's awarding of the Meritorious Service Award for a counterterrorism operation I did in the Middle East. And then chose me out of 2,000 officers to be his executive assistant. But then in the grand jury, after I had gone public over torture, I was never much of an officer in the first place. So welcome to the club.
Yeah, I almost wear it as a badge of honor that if the people Indeed. That I'm speaking out against for the atrocities and the horrors don't like me, well, that's good. That's okay with me.
Yeah.
I mean, I
yeah, that's right.
I examined my life at that point, and I said, you know, I'm on the verge of 44 years old. The friends I have will always be my friends. I don't need more friends. I don't need people to like me. My dog is always going to jump up and lick me in the face when I come home, because he knows who feeds him. And, you know, my son and my wife and my family are always going to be there for me. And I know I have the utmost confidence in this, and that one day soon, everybody will look at this situation and say that it was wrong. Everybody. And when that day comes, I can look my son in the face with dignity and say,
that's right.
This is how you stand up for what's right.
You are clearly on the right side of history here. This is not something that can be whitewashed forever. The truth always comes out. Sometimes it takes a long time, but the truth always comes out. And at the end of the day, we want our children to be proud of us. We want to be able to go to our graves knowing that we had done the right thing when faced with that choice. And it is absolutely indisputable that you did the right thing. I know that you're paying a personal price for this. With that said, I was very glad to see that you've made a decision to run for Congress. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was definitely not something that was planned. If you would have asked me, a few months ago, I would have said absolutely not. But month after month after month, since I have returned from Gaza, since July of last year, I've been going to Washington, D.C. and spending a week in Washington, D.C. out of every month, specifically to knock on the doors of Congress, to talk to senators and representatives, Republican and Democrat, about various House resolutions or joint resolutions, and asking them hard questions. That House Resolution 3565 states no longer allowing these advanced offensive lethal munitions to Israel, which they are clearly using in Gaza, thermobaric 2,000-pound bombs, joint deployed aerial munitioned 1,500-pound bombs, GBUs, the stuff that we used in Afghanistan and Iraq. And when I asked them across the span of our political body of Congress, answers were everything from, we're trying to push this through, obviously, because we wrote the legislation. We need help with that. The other end of the spectrum was, oh, we know it's happening, and man, we support it. Israel first. Israel should get all of our taxes and all of our weapons and all of our money, and everybody in Gaza is Hamas, and they should all die. These are things that were said from our members of Congress, Tom Cotton, Randy Fine. And there was a large part Lindsey in the Graham. Middle, Lindsey Graham. And then there's a large part in the middle, the majority, whose answers were, well, it's complicated. And so I asked myself,
yeah, it's actually not why, that complicated.
It's exactly. It's, I was like, it's not complicated. You're compromised. That's the problem. It's not that the issue is complicated. The issue is clear, especially after this proposed peace plan that the UN Security Council brought in as UN Resolution 2803 that declares the ceasefire. At that point, why should the United States be giving any offensive munitions whatsoever to Israel? Why? But we still do it. And when I brought that to their attention, oh, well, it's not as simple as that. I'm like, okay, so this doesn't have anything to do with what's right or wrong. You're compromised somehow, either ethically, morally, financially, or you're just, you just don't stand for America first. But there's something wrong with you if you think that this is a complicated issue. And as I started to look into it, I started to realize that, yes, the majority, Democrat and Republican, of our Congress are compromised, mostly financially, some ethically, financially, or both. And I realized that the only way we're ever going to have change that Americans want is to have elected officials that aren't compromised, that put Americans first, that aren't compromised politically, that aren't compromised by the influence of a foreign government, i.e., in this case, Israel. And I looked down the list. I started to put pieces together. I'm like, why is the entire, every member of the House Armed Services Committee, the HASC, Democrat and Republican, minority and majority, every single one of them takes money from AIPAC? That is a problem. That is a deep problem. So I decided to run for Congress, and I decided to run on the platform of, I will take no money whatsoever from any PAC, any lobbyist group, any military industrial complex interest, any large donors, none. Grassroots, because you don't need money to win votes. You need money to seize power. And I don't want to seize power. I want to represent Americans for interests back home and put, and dare I say it, Americans first.
And I want to get into that a little bit deeper in a second. I need to take a short break and say that I want to talk to you about something that really matters to me. That is medical freedom and being able to make your own healthcare decisions. That's why I'm proud to partner with All Family Pharmacy. They're a U.S.-based licensed compounding pharmacy that works with licensed providers to give people access to medications like ivermectin and mebendazole, and they ship directly to your door. Let's be honest, when flu season hits or when the system gets overwhelmed, the last thing you want to do is to have to scramble to deal with delays or to be told that you can't get what you and your family might need. Being prepared is not political, it's just smart. I like All Family Pharmacy because they believe, like I do, that patients should have options. They should have privacy and the right to be proactive about their own health. You don't wait until your house is on fire before buying a fire extinguisher. Same idea here. So take control and get prepared. Go to allfamilypharmacy.com/John and use my code JOHN10 to get 10% off your order. That's allfamilypharmacy.com/John, promo code JOHN10. Anthony, getting a little bit deeper into this, I feel as you do that this is the greatest human rights issue of our time. It's something that, in my view, is actually quite black and white. This is not something that's a shade of gray. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, the Israeli government came out and finally admitted that the numbers that we've seen of killed and wounded in Gaza that had been released by the Palestinian Ministry of Health are true numbers. For the last 2.5 years, the Israelis have said, that's the Hamas Ministry of Health, they're making those numbers up. Actually, the numbers are very conservative because, as you said at the very beginning of our conversation, we still don't have any idea how many people are still underneath the rubble, long dead and uncounted. So my question to you then is, you've announced your candidacy for Congress. What kind of a response are you getting in North Carolina when you raise these issues that to us, as I said, are really black and white? Do people understand the import of what you're talking about here? And are they able to intellectually place America first in U.S. foreign policy?
Well, part of my campaign is a campaign of informing, because most Americans, well, let's face it, most Americans don't even vote. We could start there. And those that do, when they go into that polling booth, they go down the line with either an R and a D. I'm an R, so regardless of who's running. I'm a D, regardless of who's running. And what I'm exposing is that, okay, R or D, what we've seen over the last multiple administrations and decades is not putting Americans first. So when we talk about healthcare, better healthcare options right here in America, education, childcare, a living wage, all these things that when you ask yourself, you know, I brought this up one day to a constituent and I was talking to him about healthcare, housing, equal pay, education. Oh, that's all socialism. I was like, really? Okay. Well, then why does every military recruiter entice a possible recruit with those four things? Join the Army, GI Bill, housing, equal pay, healthcare. Those sound like American values. So when I ask myself, why can't we have those things here? We can. We can have those things here without even having to look at how we change taxes or how we manipulate the currency. We don't have to do that. We could just stop giving Israel $189 billion every year in military aid, direct financial aid, or through this memorandum of understanding that we hold with Israel that's a 10-year MOU. Every year on the dot, the end of the fiscal year, we send them a check for $3.9 billion. When this United States government was shut down this past year, in our longest shutdown in history, we still sent our $3.9 billion plus a $6.9 billion military aid booster to Israel on October 1st as Americans suffer. So I'm waking people up to that to say, for example, in my district, the incumbent Republican, he doesn't live in the district.
Oh my God. My
district 13 of North Carolina has a medium household income of about $84,000. And this individual, Brad Knott, doesn't even live in the district. And he lives in the glitzy glam Riviera part of Raleigh, outside of our district, in a $2.2 million house. He has never served in the military. The majority of District 13 are active duty or retirees. He takes AIPAC money, and his position is Israel first. In fact, one of the clips that I will show during the campaign is during the Pam Bondi hearing that just happened last week. He had the floor to speak and ask our attorney general questions. And did he ask her about the Epstein files? Did he ask her about arrests? Did he ask her about accountability? Did he ask her about the providing the truth to the American people? No, he used his platform to grandstand, to celebrate Pam Bondi's performance as the AG. Is that someone you want in Congress representing you? Someone that puts Israel first, takes money from a foreign lobby, has never served in the military, doesn't even live in our district, and is living high on the hog in a $2.2 million mansion while the rest of us down here suffer? Is that who you want representing you in D.C.? I don't think people do, but they don't know that, because when they go to the ballot box, they see R or D. So I'm putting a face behind, right now, at this point in history, the candidate matters far more than the party.
Couple of observations that I wanted to get your reaction to. I was on Capitol Hill recently. I worked on Capitol Hill on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff for a little more than 2 years. And then I worked on the House side before that. And one of the things that I've never understood is why in the world members of Congress would have the Israeli flag outside their office. You have the American flag, you're a member of the American Congress. But you go to Lindsey Graham's office or Tom Cotton's office or half of the Florida House delegation, their office, and they've got the American flag on one side of the door and the Israeli flag on the other side of the door. We have a Republican member of Congress from Florida who actually wore an Israeli IDF uniform onto the floor of the House of Representatives.
Brian Mast.
I also happened to be in I happened to be in Miami a couple of weeks ago, and there was an article in the Miami Herald about a woman in Miami Beach who posted a comment on Facebook that she supported Palestinian human rights. The next day, Miami police investigating your anti-Semitic comment on Facebook that you're for Palestinian human rights. She told him, go fly a kite. Well, it turns out that the Florida legislature earlier this year passed a bill into law making it a criminal act to criticize Israel. Now, the courts are going to throw this out because it's patently unconstitutional. But to make matters worse, when it was passed into law, Governor Ron DeSantis did not immediately sign it. What he did was, he flew to Tel Aviv, drove to Jerusalem, and signed it in the presence of Benjamin Netanyahu. So I'm at a loss as to where the America First is here. This doesn't make any sense to me at all. What is the response that you are getting as you campaign around your district? What are people saying to you about these issues?
More and more Americans are becoming more aware every day of the influence of a foreign government, namely Israel, in our Congress, in our executive branch, even in our judicial branch. They're becoming aware of those ties. The Epstein saga is simply another chapter in that anthology of what we're now seeing and what people are waking up to. And to the point you made that in the United States, those liberties that we hold dear, freedom of speech, freedom to protest, freedom to assemble, right to bear arms, are being infringed upon not by some horrible, vicious enemy like Iran or China It's coming from someone that our Congress declares as our closest ally. And to your point, when you walk down the halls of our Congress, the only flag you should see is the United States flag. And depending if they're a senator or whichever state they're from, perhaps a state flag. Can you imagine if you walk down the halls of Congress and a congressman of Chinese ancestry had the flag of China posted outside of his office? Or me, Mexican. I am of Mexican descent. I had the Mexican flag posted outside of my door. The backlash on that would be insurmountable. So why does Israel get a pass? And it's because they have invested billions of dollars over many years of that manipulative propaganda to think that Israel first is America first. And I'm here to tell Americans, having seen behind the curtain, that that is not true. That is not true. And if we don't stand up and start to turn our Congress with Americans that want to put American first, Americans first, that change has to happen, and it has to happen soon. Because even, as you mentioned, Brian Mass shows up wearing an IDF uniform. Just last week, Randy Fine says that dogs are more valuable than Muslims. Can you imagine if a Rashida Tlaib said that dogs are more valuable than Jews? She would have been thrown out of Congress that day. So the hypocrisy is what demonstrates the control and the power. You know, it's often been said, show me who you cannot criticize and I'll show you who controls you. So the American public is more and more waking up to that, to this idea of why are we giving billions and billions of dollars to a foreign country? Oh, Israel has universal health care, universal education, the standard living wage, and subsidized housing? Huh. Who pays for that? We do. So I intend to make that more and more evident and clear on the campaign trail. And this campaign is not only about me running for Congress. It's about informing Americans to start making more educated and informed decisions on who we elect to go to Congress. Because the truth is, the Randy Fines, the Brian Mass, the Donald Trumps, we voted for them. So we bear responsibility to be informed. And if you ask any American out there, hey, who's our congressman for District 13? I don't know. Who'd you vote for? Republican. Okay, so we're still voting along party lines. And I think most Americans now realize that the Republican Party and the MAGA lie is not keeping us out of war and bringing peace. And the Democrats are just the same side or the other side of the same coin. They have not demonstrated a backbone either. In fact, the Democrats in totality take more money from AIPAC than Republicans by a large margin.
Absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. So,
Anthony,
you know, the facts are the facts.
Where can people learn more about that's it. And we either have to just accept the facts and admit our faults or do something about it and change things.
Absolutely.
Where can people learn more about you and about your campaign?
So prior to me announcing my campaign, I had no social media. So now I am on social media. So people can follow my social media. I'm on all the platforms. I'm on I'm on YouTube. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Upscrolled. I'm on X. So follow me there. I post every day. Every day I post some type of information about either an aspect of government or Palestine or issues in our nation. But then people can also go to www.aguilarforuscongress.com, and that'll take you to my campaign webpage where you can learn about my platform, my priorities, also a big, obviously a platform for veterans rights, veterans benefits and veterans rights. You know, there's a big gap in veteran care as well. People think that, oh, the VA's got it covered. Not true, because this current administration is taking money from the VA to fund ICE and to fund this massive war buildup we see in Iran. I mean, that doesn't come for free. I mean, deploying two carrier strike groups comes at a cost, and they take from the VA. So veterans benefits, veterans rights is a critical part of my platform, being a veteran myself, but also the veteran community that I serve. So on that website, you can find out how to donate. You can find out my platform. You can see ways to help. If you're in the district and you want to volunteer, door knocking, phone calls, putting out signage, helping run events, helping run town halls, donating if you don't live in the district or even if you do. But the biggest part, the biggest thing for everyone in the country we're only censored if we allowed ourselves to be censored. Push back. When you see that information, realize that someone like me speaking out to say, hey, America, let's put America first. That's not anti-Semitic.
That's right.
That's pro-American.
It's
in no way is it anti-Semitic.
Exactly.
So when you hear that rhetoric, realize that's the evil manipulation of propaganda, because if we're divided, if we're arguing with each other over race or what the problems in this country, all immigrants are bad, focus on ICE. We're not focusing on what's actually going on. It's here's the left hand, don't look at what the right hand's doing. And right now in this country, we've got to look at what the left hand is doing and at what the right hand is doing. And we have to get involved and take action on both. So as donations, that's great. Volunteering, super. But more importantly, to all 814,000 constituents of North Carolina District 13, come November 3rd on the the general election date, vote. Get out and vote. And vote for the values and the candidates you want, not by the party. We have to break that paradigm. And I'll tell you, when people say to me, oh, well, that's the American way of politics, the Democrats, the Republicans. Not true. Yet another lie.
No.
Our first president ran unaffiliated. And before we had the Democratic Party, the parties before that ran on a multi-poly party system. We had the Whigs, we had the National Unionists, we had the Democratic Republicans, we had the Republicans. Then the Democrats emerge with Andrew Jackson against John Quincy Adams, and they actually stood up a party called the Anti-Jackson Party to oppose him, and he won. We didn't have Republicans until Lincoln ran, and on Lincoln's second term, he didn't even run as a Republican. He ran as a National Unionist. Until Ulysses S. Grant that we had this Republican-Democrat, Republican-Democrat, Republican-Democrat. And in that time, out of the 39 administrations and 18, or Republican and 18 that have been Democrat, I ask America, where are we? Where are we? $38 trillion in debt, wars across the world, robbing our future, our posterity Social Security, blowing that through the roof. We're going to leave nothing for our generation that follows us. And if you pause and you actually sit down with Americans and you talk to them about the facts, they clearly see that, why would we vote for that? It's a matter of information, education, and then actually getting out there to vote. Voting does matter. That's another powerful tool of the evil propaganda, is that voting doesn't matter. It does.
Yes, it does indeed. Anthony Aguilar, such a thrill to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking the time and for giving us the benefits of your experience. Good to meet you.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to share the morning and speak with you, and really appreciate
you
being on your show. I have a ton of respect for everything you have done as a patriot. And I do consider that, when a whistleblower comes forward, that is patriotism, because they're putting themselves at risk for the good of their country. That is the definition of patriotism.
Absolutely right. That is it. Well, until next time, glad you could join us.